It's 10 minutes after 3 o'clock. We have with us today Georgine Bailey, representing the Legislative Fiscal Office. Jamie Penn is our clerk today. What we'll do is we have advertised today for our activities Senate Bill 1088 as well as Senate Bill 7. We are taking them in that particular order, and I'm sorry that there are folks who may have come out of their way to take 7 on first. However, we believe that we will be able to go ahead and get through 1088 in a little bit quicker order. And what I would like to do is I would like to go ahead and have relative to 1088, I would like to have someone speak to the substantive issues and take about 5 minutes, and then I would like someone else to take another 5 minutes and speak to the substantive issues on the other side of the issue. Recognize, please, that this is a subcommittee of the Subcommittee of Ways and Means General Government, and we deal with the appropriations side. So at this point, if I could just go ahead and ask, I have, let's see, I believe you have a list, John Von der Lending, John Von Lendingham. Are you prepared to speak, let's see, on behalf of 1088? Okay, please come forward and state your name for the record. And let's see, Representative Krupp can figure what that funny looking little piggy bank is right there.
Oh, yeah.
if you've been alerted, then it goes to twice as much money. This is the American Cancer Society for acronyms. We're here for a very short period of time with term limits, and acronyms is something that we may not always understand.
Is there anyone in the audience who doesn't understand what that's all about? Well, I would expect that, Ted, but basically don't use an acronym or you're going to pay us 25 cents.
We're good to say. Okay, Mr. Van Lendingham, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Van Lendingham. I'm a lawyer with a nonprofit law center in Eugene, Lane County Law and Advocacy. I'm speaking on behalf and in support of Senate Bill 1088B. I'm the principal drafter of that bill, and I am also the principal drafter of two documents that you're now being handed that are quite lengthy. The bill is quite lengthy. It has 29 sections. Almost every one of them is substantive and is significant. The legislative history document, quote-unquote, the comments, explains in great detail each one of those sections. Let me just say a couple of preliminary things. This is a coalition bill. This was negotiated and drafted and redrafted and redrafted and renegotiated by a coalition of a number of groups, and those groups are listed on the front page of my comments section. Almost every landlord-tenant, significant landlord-tenant legislation since 1973, when the Omnibus Residential Landlord and Tenant Act was adopted, and 1975, when it was amended to include manufactured housing tenancies, almost every bill amending that law has been a negotiated compromise coalition effort, which is exactly what this is. This group, I've listed the members, quite a few of them are here today to show their support. They include the Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, Chuck Carpenter and John Brenneman, Pat Schwach, Oregon State Tenants Association, Frank Burleson, Residents Coalition, Emily Stuberlee, Multifamily Housing Council, Don Miner from the Manufacturers, Pat Lewis's organization, Building Codes Division, is here, Sean Miller on behalf of Oregon Rental Housing Association, Dave Shelar, the Ombudsman for the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. I may have left somebody out, but this group represented landlords, the owners of parks and marinas, tenants, the tenants who own their homes and rent a space, manufacturers, lenders, and the state which regulates those parks. As with any coalition bill, we each got something and gave up something. Every issue that the opponents have raised in the last couple of months of hearings have been issues that we negotiated over and over again. For example, the most significant issue is what we call forced removal or termination removal. That issue went through 15 drafts of our group, and it changed significantly from draft 1 to draft 15. Termination removal involves a landlord's right, regulated here, to terminate a tenancy and force a home to be removed from the park because it is in disrepair. You need to understand that what we're talking about here is someone's home. The tenant owns the home. The landlord owns the space. This is not your typical tenancy in which the tenant rents both the home and the land on which the home is. Here, the tenant owns the home. That investment by a tenant could be that tenant's largest investment in his or her life. And a home without a space is virtually worthless. So forcing the removal of a home is a hugely significant event for the tenant. It's also, we've come to understand, a hugely significant event for the lender. These homes have mortgages just like your stick-built homes do, 20 and 30-year mortgages. A 20-year mortgage on a home that can be evicted because it's 10 years old, just because of its age, would be worthless. And the lenders have made it very clear to us that they are not likely to lend on homes if their investment, if their security, can be at risk that way. So the lenders have been very strong supporters of the compromise embodied in this bill. What we've done here is make it clear for the landlord. The landlord can require repairs, but that the landlord cannot evict a home just because it's 10 years old or just because it's a single wide. That would be like saying to you in your home that the city can say to you, you've got to tear your home down or move it off your lot because it's 10 years old or 1,500 square feet. This bill says a landlord can't do that. A landlord can make the tenant repair the home. And if the tenant doesn't repair the home, and we provided a complicated process for doing that, then the landlord can require the home to be removed. The tenants support that. The tenants want homes to be well maintained. This bill does not prevent the landlord from upgrading or maintaining the park. Tenants want well-maintained homes because a poorly maintained home next to theirs decreases the value of their home. That's probably more than 5 minutes. That's the most significant issue in the bill. As I said, there are 29 sections. I'd be glad to respond to any questions about any other section or even that section.
Okay. For the committee, then, what we're doing is we're going to hear both pro and the cons as substantive issues relative to 1088, and then we'll go ahead and go into the fiscal issues. So are there questions of Mr. Vanenham with regard to his position relative to speaking in favor of 1088 and the substantive issues relative to 1088? Representative Trump is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 4 of the legislation talks about making older mobile homes. And there's a concern expressed here that this bill would prevent the removal of an older mobile home, even if it was in the original contract language. Is that your assessment of Section 4?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp. It does prohibit a landlord from evicting a tenant under new tenancies or existing tenancies. Part of your question was, does it apply to existing tenancies? The answer is yes. Section 5 of the bill makes it apply to both kinds of tenancies. And it prohibits a landlord from acquiring the removal of a home, evicting a home, just because of its age, size, style, construction material. A landlord can evict a home if the home is not maintained and the tenant fails to maintain it. The landlord essentially gives a 30-day eviction notice, says, for example, your home has peeling paint. If you don't get it repainted, that's disrepair, you can be evicted. So that's how we've compromised here. The landlord can force maintenance. That was not clear under existing law. So that's an improvement for landlords. They've gained something there. They've lost something as well. That was your original question. Yes, they've lost the right if they had it. As a tenant lawyer, I don't believe they had it. But if they did have it, they've lost the right to evict a home just because it's 10 years old or 20 years old or a single wide. There's no element of fault there because the home is 10 years old. What we said is if the tenant has failed to maintain it, then yes, you can evict it. Does that answer?
Yes, it does. Thank you. And then the second question, if I follow, Mr. Chair, is the right to resell to anyone the fact that the home
remains there for a year after the eviction. Why is that language in there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, I believe you're referring to the testimony from one of the opponents, which I saw about an hour ago. And that testimony is confusing a couple of different things. This is an extremely complicated area, so I'm not critical of the confusion. What we've done in the bill is make clear that during the 30-day notice period, remember the landlord first gives a notice to the tenant. It has to be at least 30 days. The landlord can make it longer. In which the landlord says, fix the peel and paint or remove your home. The bill allows the tenant to get an extension. For example, if you can't paint a home in a rainy November, you can get an extension of time to paint the home. During that period, the tenant has the right to sell the home in place. In place means that the purchaser can apply to become a tenant. Okay. So during that notice period, the tenant has the right, that's from 30 to 90 days, has the right to sell the home in place. The landlord has criteria. This is a standard landlord criteria for approving a tenant. The landlord does not have to approve a tenant or a prospective tenant, a purchaser, who's a drug dealer, who's a credit risk, who's a bad actor. The landlord gets to apply his or her standard criteria for accepting that purchaser as a tenant. So during that 30 to 90 days, the tenant has the right to sell. The buyer takes subject to the repair notice. So if the landlord approves the purchaser is going to have to fix the home or remove it at the end of the period. So that's one of the situations. The second situation is, let's say the tenant abandons the home. This is existing law. Whether this bill passes or not, this is the way the world works right now under Oregon's Residential Landlord Tenant Act. Try not to use an acronym.
I must say.
Under existing law, there's a very long statute on abandoned property that we adopted in 97, the same coalition. And in that process, the tenant gets 45 days plus another 30 days to remove the home or sell it. The tenant's out, the tenancy is over, but the home is still in space. It's difficult and expensive to move home. During that period, this bill makes clear that the tenant has the right to sell the home in place, again, to a purchaser who wants to leave it there. But we've added three conditions. Tenant has to pay the space rent during that time period, has to maintain the home, and cannot enter the park without the landlord's written permission. Those are all clarifications that are not in existing law and are benefits to landlords. So the landlord's position is strengthened with regard to what the tenant can do during that 45 plus 30 days. Now, the third situation, and where the year comes in, has to do with a lien holder, a lender. Okay? The lender's position is that they've got a lot of money invested in this home, or secured by this home. They can't take it until the tenant's rights are extinguished. But after the tenant's abandoned the home and failed to remove it, the lender has the right to come in under the 97 legislation and say to the landlord, I want a one-year contract in which I get to have you, I can make you leave the home on the space, and I can try and sell it. Okay? During that 1 year, the lender has to pay the space rent and has to maintain the home. The landlord and the lender have a written rental agreement. A written agreement. It's called a storage agreement. The lender's not a tenant. That's the 1 year. That's already there. But this bill makes it work. Makes these two concepts fit together.
And one final question, follow up, final. Why do we really, what's the real reason we need to do this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, there are actually two driving forces. The tenants, this has been the number one issue for park residents and fresh housing residents since 1997. Without this, they feel that their investment in their home is insecure, both in terms of having a home and also protecting their investment. Secondly, the lenders have made it quite clear that without some sort of protection on their risk, that they're not likely to continue to lend, which would have a significant negative implication on the whole industry, all of us, landlords, tenants, manufacturers, everybody, even lawyers.
Thank you, Mr. Linehan. Let me just follow up with one item while we have Mr. Linehan here, and he appears to this is passed through the Businesses and Consumer Affairs unanimously with DUPAS and then referred to the Ways and Means. This the fiscal issue that we're going to examine
in just a moment is relative to the ombudsman fee that's involved. And that's really what we're going to be examining here in just a moment. I'd like to go ahead and have Representative Nestor be ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, does your client self-support the fee increase?
Mr. Chair, Representative Meserly, I think that it would probably be more appropriate for the residents to answer that, but maybe they can nod their heads. That's them, and very strongly, and have from the beginning. They pay the fee. They want the services that the fees pay.
Senator Troy, do you have a question?
No, I just wanted to indicate that I'm sure they wanted the fee because that's been one of their priorities.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Representative
Leonard. Yes, sir. You made reference to bad actors being potentially excluded from the park. Are you talking about those people involved in criminal activity or people such as Lieutenant Crook?
And how I knew. when he said that,
perhaps, Mr. Chairman, they were masquerading as a House member.
Thank you very much. And we'll call forward to Mr. Ray Phelps, relative to the Coalition of Mobile Home Park
Owners. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. First, I'd like to correct the written testimony. It was the Chair for Sean Smith, but he had to leave, and so I'm pitching for him. First, I'd like to acknowledge that this bill and a number of similar bill, House Bill 3098, have already moved through several stages of the legislative process. We're aware of that. We just wanted to raise with you the idea that though there has been a great deal of support, it is not universal with regard to mobile homes. A fairly large group of park owners have come forward to express their concerns over this legislation, and they are three. First, these folks are concerned that this legislation will make it more difficult for them to upgrade their parks. And that deals with, as Representative Krupp was talking to the previous witness, the idea of upgrading and whether or not you can modernize as time goes on. I think that exchange pretty much spoke for itself. Second, the legislation gives tenants who have been evicted the right to resell their mobile home to anyone and allows the mobile home to remain in the park for up to a year after the original tenant was evicted. This is a concern in as much as the tenant convicted, for example, could be a drug dealer, not necessarily a member of the House of Representatives, and could sell his home to a friend or acquaintance, and the owner of the mobile park would have little power to put an end to the transaction in a timely manner.
Sure. Isn't the case now, present law allows the owner of a mobile home to park to veto a sale? Is that true now?
That's my understanding, but I will step back if somebody says differently.
Okay. People are nodding their head yes. Mm-hmm. But the owner does have, under present law, the right to veto any sale. Okay.
And lastly, there is the concern about increased lawsuits because of the what's called the failure to maintain. And that has been the experience in California, as it's been reported to me. And that is a concern of the folks that we're representing. I believe my time was absorbed in the Q&A on the first two questions, and I have nothing further to say.
Thank you very much. Are there any other questions for Mr. Phelps at this time?
I have the same question. Do your constituents or your clientele want to support the fee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, I don't know. That never came up. They don't like the bill, so we never got into the other substantive parts of the bill. So it would be unfair for me to say one way or the other, sir.
Thank you, Senator Phelps.
Was your group involved in the so-called compromises that brought forward the bill and you just backed away, or were you just excluded, or what?
I don't know. I need help on that. Can I? I'm a little embarrassed. If you don't mind, please.
Here, Senator Phelps, John Van Lanningham. I believe that Mr. Phelps' clients participated or were members, and they may well have quit over this bill, We're members of groups that were participants in our negotiations, and in fact, a lawyer from Portland, who I believe represents one of the primary clients, participated in each of the meetings. So, yeah, I thank you, Andy.
They were part of the compromise, but now they no longer support it. Thank you, Kate.
Thank you very much. Further questions for Mr. Phelps?
Thank you, Mr. Phelps. Appreciate it.
We do have with us today Mr. Joe Brewer, who is from the Building Codes Division. And Mr. Brewer is well respected in that particular area and has some knowledge, and he's got a hand up and the whole nine yards, so we'll go ahead.
The chairman is too kind. For the record, my name is Joe Brewer. I'm the administrator at the Building Codes Division. The Building Codes Division has worked with the coalition on this issue over the interim. We believe the bill is a good example of folks coming together trying to solve mutual problems. Our responsibility in this field is to oversee the construction and maintenance of manufactured dwelling parks. We believe this bill will resolve many safety issues we've observed and will improve the safety and livability of the parks in our state. We also believe the bill will help park owners maintain their facilities in a safer and more sanitary manner, preserving the residents' privacy at the same time. The bill will require a working smoke detector in every manufactured dwelling. We believe that will definitely save lives and reduce property damage across the state. We believe the bill provides a clear line of distinction between residents' and park owners' responsibilities for utility connections, stormwater damage, and other construction, installation, and maintenance issues. We believe it will make it easier for park residents and owners and state agencies to resolve disputes outside the court system, which we believe is a very good thing. And it will eliminate any possibility of a park owner requiring the removal of an existing home simply because it was built before the HUD standard was put in place, or because it's too old. I'd be happy to take any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Joe, are you prepared to discuss the ombudsman's responsibility that is the issue of the fiscal matter at hand? Who is responsible for the oversight for the ombudsman?
Mr. Chairman, that's the Housing Department. I believe Mr. Sheeler is here to do that.
Okay.
We have worked with Mr. Sheeler on many occasions and find him to be very effective at helping to resolve these issues.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Are there any questions of Mr. Brewer? Mr. Sheeler, would you like to come forward, please? State your name for the record, please.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is David Sheeler. I'm the Manufactured Dwelling Park Ombudsman of the State of Oregon. With me today is our Chief Executive Officer of Financial Services, Jack Kenney. I'll tell you a little bit about the program. The Manufactured Dwelling Park Ombudsman Program is a part of Oregon Housing and Community Services, the State of Oregon agency. We came into being by way of the 1989 Oregon State Legislature to assist landlords and tenants of manufactured dwelling parks throughout the state work out the kinds of disagreement and occurrences that are an everyday part of what happens in manufactured dwelling parks. We help organize groups and facilitate coalitions much like the one John Van Lanningham was talking about today, in the spirit of getting people together to work out the kinds of situations that lead to bills like 1088. I'm here today primarily to address any questions you might have, any concerns you might have that relate to the additional fees that would come with our program. Initially,
that is true, right?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Right. What will you do with the additional fees, and how will they help?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cho, those additional fees will allow the program to expand our services. We currently have 3 staff members that provide services to over 1,500 parks, representing over 60,000 spaces. We want to have the ability to expand the program to a degree that will allow full service to that community. The way we think we'll do that, and we're neutral on the bill, it's important that you know that the bill came to us by way of the tenants. This is what we would do if the bill came to fruition today. We would expand that by creating video seminars that we would send to the tenants and landlords of the parks throughout the state of Oregon. Those videos would include landlord-tenant information, updated information about Oregon landlord and tenant law, how to organize tenants' associations and the benefits of those associations and parks, and information directly about mediation and conflict resolution. So we would create those and disseminate those statewide. Additionally, we would create brochures that would follow those mediation videos and, again, disseminate those throughout the state of Oregon. Make our office a more resource-oriented agency. We'd also create a website and develop plans for electronic communication with park patrons throughout the state of Oregon, working in cooperation with both landlord and tenant trade groups as we broaden our ability to serve those people. So we're creating the kinds of activities in cooperation with the people that we work with on a day-to-day basis to broaden the help to landlords and tenants of the state of Oregon.
Thank you very much. Before we proceed any further, we've had an opportunity to hear the substantive sites to Senate Bill 1088, which had been passed through with a due pass recommendation from the House Committee on Business and Consumer Affairs. And we've now heard from the Building Codes Division and just briefly from the State Ombudsman. What I would like to do is now go ahead and have our Legislative Fiscal Office representative, Georgine Bailey, go ahead and present to us the issues relative now to the fiscal matter at hand.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. The bill in Section 28 simply increases the special assessment levied on each manufactured dwelling from $3 per unit per year to $6 per unit per year. Attached to my memorandum is a copy of the fiscal impact form that was prepared by our office. And you'll see in the table that it is estimated that there will be $510,000 generated on the revenue side, and total expenditures are estimated at $426,000. The bill does not include at this point any authorization for expenditure limitation. And Legislative Fiscal is not going to recommend that be included. The reason for that is this assessment is assessed and selected through the County Assessor's Office, and the Department does not expect to get any or, if any, very little revenue from this bill if it passes until approximately November 2000. If they need any expenditure limitation, once they set the revenue, they can always come to the emergency board.
Okay. We've heard the recommendations. I may be appropriate. Mr. Kenny, did you have additional testimony to add to Mr. Shuler?
Chair Butler, I'm just here to answer any questions you may have on PAS.
Are there questions relative to the fiscal issues that have been brought before us? Representative Krupp is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, $510,000 additional revenue, and you're going to hire one person. Where else are you going to go?
The Representative Butler, Representative Krupp, the largest piece of the fiscal impact on this is through contract mediation services. We currently, in the Ombudsman budget, have approximately $280,000 for contracts, and that covers five counties. As Mr. Shuler indicated, we're looking to expand the availability of the mediation services throughout the state.
Representative Metzger is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either one of you folks, gentlemen, aware of any opposition to these fee increases?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Israel, I'm not aware of any opposition to this. The money would come directly from the tenants of the parks, not from the landlords. This is not any part of general funds money. The money is generated directly from the tenants. The tenants are the ones that brought this information forward and originally supported Senate Bill 648, which was their initial bill to do this. So I'm not aware of any opposition. And it was discussed in the coalition, and I'm not aware of any opposition as a result of the coalition membership.
Additional questions of Mr. Shuler or Mr. Kenny? I beg your pardon. Senator Lynn,
Mr. Chair. And maybe it has been spoken already, but when was that last time the $3 that the commission levy, when was the last time we did that? We are increasing from $3 to $6, right? When was the $3 that has been instituted?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Lynn, that's before my history, but I believe that that was the initial amount, and anybody can correct me if they're in the audience and I'm wrong, but I believe that was the initial amount established in 1989, and that amount has not changed through the years whatsoever.
Other questions of the witnesses? Thank you very much, Senator.
It seems to me like this is a simple issue and we ought to stay at work session.
We had one other that signed up and I wanted to make sure that Don Miner felt comfortable that the testimony has been presented. Okay. All right. Thank you. Having indicated that the issues have been addressed, I'm going to go ahead and close the public session of the Senate Bill 1088, and we will open up the public, we'll open up the work session on Senate Bill 1088B. We have a recommendation for legislative fiscal officer.
Chair, I move those recommendations.
It's been moved by Senator Stroh that we move the recommendations of legislative fiscal office relative to Senate Bill 1088. Are there any objections? Seeing none, it will go with a due pass recommendation for the full race remaining. We'll so order, and Senator Stroh, if you'd like to carry that on for the full race remaining,
I will.
And you can carry it also to the Senate?
Yes.
Now let's see. It's been to the Senate, but this will be...
It's not been to the floor.
It's not been to the floor.
It has been to the floor. Okay.
But it was before it was to be A and A and goes.
A and goes. So it will have to be for concurrence.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. For the concurrence, then, on the floor. Senator Farioli?
Mr. Chairman, this is a bill in a long succession of work that Senator Crowe has undertaken on behalf of both the... owners associations and the mobile home or manufactured housing association working between those two groups to bring compromise out of a very difficult climate situation. You heard these bills, very similar bills and similar issues in that previous legislative session, and it was only because of a very hard series of compromise meetings that we got any legislation through in the last legislative session. This looks like further progress on that issue, and I think you should be commended for the work in the area.
Senator Stroh, it's appropriate that you do carry this, and you are to be commended. Thank you very much. We've seen that coalition before today. As to the House side, carrying it to the House, Representative Leonard will carry it to the House. That being the case, we'll go ahead then, and we'll post all further relative to 1088. Thank you very much. We're now going on to Senate Bill 7. This should be a fairly fast and quick one here today. We'll open a public session on Senate Bill 7. We'll need to understand the all of the ramifications of 7, and I'm not sure that there's anyone here that is prepared to speak directly to all of the issues on Senate Bill 7. Perhaps we could go ahead and have Dallas Wyand, representing the Legislative Fiscal Office, go ahead and make a brief presentation of the Senate Bill 7 today and go.
Chairman of the committee, Senate Bill 7A and Gross essentially repeals House Bill 3349, which was passed back earlier on, and effectively increased the retirement income of state retirees, and because their retirement income will be increased their benefits by the amount of the tax. This bill would also require the public employees' retirement program to recalculate what the retirement benefits would be by after repealing House Bill 3349. It would exempt from income taxation in federal and Oregon retirement incomes. And it would also, that would take effect to January 1st, 2000. And effective January 1, 2002, it would also exempt from income taxation up to $50,000 of private retirement income. That, by definition, I understand to be any retirement income other than from federal or state of Oregon retirement plans. It was referred to the Senate Revenue Committee. It was passed out of the Senate Revenue Committee as amended, and then was referred here to Ways and Means. You have before you a copy of the draft measure summary that came out of the Senate Committee on Revenue. There's also a revenue impact because it would be a loss of revenue to the general fund because of a reduction of income tax receipts because they're no longer be taxing retirement income. There's also a fiscal impact statement because there would be costs associated with implementing this implementation, both with the Public Employees Retirement System and the Oregon Department of Revenue. There's also an impact on employers' contribution rate. They're expected to go down in the future, so there would be an impact there.
Very modest impact. If I understand all of the zeros there, that comes up to about $250 million. Immediately in the next biennium after nearly $100 million impact and then over $30 billion biennium. I think it probably would be appropriate at this time, if he's willing to do so, we have Mr. Fred McDonald with us, and I can't think of anyone in the state who's probably more qualified to address this issue. Would you be willing to do that, Mr. McDonald? As the director of the state public employee retirement system.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be back before the committee again. Members of the committee, Fred McCollum, the director of the public employees retirement system. As you know, the taxation of PERS retirees has gone down a long and somewhat difficult road over the last several years. And the last action that was taken, indeed, as Dallas explained, is that House Bill 3349 was passed, and basically what it did was provide compensation for PERS retirees while it continued the taxation of PERS retirees. And that was done full well realizing that the revenue would continue to come into the state and that the employers that are participants in the public employees retirement system would be required to pay the bill. At that time, I would tell you that the PERS board was very much opposed to the method that was implemented, that they felt that the employers should not have to pay that bill while the state benefited from the additional revenue. And we have heard no end to that in the last 5 to 6 months, as I think all of you are aware. That is part, not all, of the reason that that rates have increased, especially in the local government area. So the PERS system did a great deal in terms of work in order to implement 3349. I would tell you that the effort that we would have to expend to undo 3349 is significantly less, but still we would have a great deal of a number of discussions with our retiree group and those about to be retired to explain that to them, and that's why we have a fiscal impact that's before you today. And we will realize that it's a difficult, complex question. It's one that certainly has an impact on the state general fund, but it also has a very significant impact upon the governments that are participating in our plan.
Senator Trill is recognized.
Did the PERS board look at this issue of the repeal of HB 3349 and take any position on it?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Trill, our legislation committee of the board did look at it, did not take a position on it, and it did not go to the full board for their review because of that. And their position basically was a no position.
What are the arguments for and against, if you could just lay them out for us? What are the arguments for repealing and against repealing?
The arguments for repealing are equity to local governments, and I would say without a doubt that that is the major there's been a change, however, since 3349 was enacted by the legislature, and that is the court decision exempting federal retirees from taxation. And that does change a bit the playing field. As far as against it, I would have to say that probably the major argument against is the impact it will have on the state's general fund.
But what impact will it be on the general fund?
Well, the impact on the general fund would be a loss of revenue because of the fact that PERS retirees would no longer be taxed, and so that revenue, that tax income, would no longer come into the state.
Okay, so what they're getting for the loss of this retirement benefit, the reduction of the benefit, is no taxation, and that would have the effect basically of taking away state's revenue. But it would be consistent with what the courts have said must happen to the federal retirees, right?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that is correct. I would add a comment to that, however. There would be a reduction in state revenue. However, there would be also a reduction in state expense to the retirement system, because for the state employees, the state would not have to pay the 3349 benefit increase for state employees that are now retired. So, and I'm sure that Mr. Wayne has those numbers as far as the how they come out, but I'm sure it's still a hit on the general fund.
Is there any way of knowing which of these employees who are going to benefit by not paying taxes but are going to have their retirement reduced? Is it going to be a minus effect upon them, a plus effect? Are they going to be better off or worse off having this happen to them? Or does it vary depending upon who the retiree is and what kind of income?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cho, the latter, so the last comment. For example, for some, House Bill 3349 was a windfall. If, for example, a retiree lived in the state of Washington or the state of Nevada, they don't pay taxes, so they got a 9.89% benefit increase as a windfall. For individuals who live in the state of Oregon, it was not completely 100% whole. It did not make them completely 100% whole. So they may be better off. Some of them might be better off if Senate Bill 7 was passed. But it's a mixed thing. It really is.
How much revenue will states lose if they're not taxed?
That just the first people, or are we figuring in the private people who are not?
This figures in all the private, the federal.
President Krupp is recognized. In talking about the numbers here, essentially, in terms of state PERS retirees, because we're rescinding House Bill 3349, we're not collecting that tax either. We're not paying it out. We're not collecting it. It essentially is a wash in terms of general fund issue with state PERS retirees.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that would be absolutely right.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please, go ahead.
So then, As we look at, do you have the fiscal statement here?
I have the fiscal statement that PERS prepared. I do not have the full.
I'm sorry, Senator. I thought you were finished. I apologize. Okay. In the 2001-2003 biennium, it's showing $165 million. Is that that's an actual loss of revenue to the state of Oregon from PERS retirees in that category? Is that also a wash because we're also not paying that money out also?
I don't. Dallas probably could speak to that more accurately, but I don't believe that that would be a Warsh representative, because you have other retirees involved other than State of Oregon retirees. There are local government retirees and school retirees, so I don't believe that that would be a Warsh, like it was in your first comment when you specifically addressed state employees and state retirees.
However, it would be a Warsh for, and every biennium thereafter, if you're dealing with just state retirees, it would be a Warsh.
It would be close to a Warsh. Now, the 9.89% benefit increase was not a dollar-for-dollar offset for the dollars that the PERS retiree is taxed, but it was close.
Very close.
It was close, and it depends upon other incomes, as Senator Tro pointed out. Individual situations do enter into this.
Thank you.
Does the federal court's decision mean that we could never tax the retirement income of the federal retirees if we tax state retirees and we tax private retirees and we don't give any special benefits to state retirees? Can we tax federal retirees based on the decision?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tro, as long as they are taxed equally.
Okay, so we could do that. Rather than moving this direction to excuse all these folks from paying taxes, we could have them all pay taxes.
That is correct.
Okay. If I could just make just one comment relative to that, that is after the payment has been made from the retirement funds to compensate for the second, it was a series of rightful lawsuits that developed the fact that we had a contractual obligation that developed the tax-free nature of the retirement for public employee retirement, and that became damaged, and that was compensated.
It was the Hughes decision, actually, Mr. Chairman. It was the Hughes decision. Ragsdale had to do with another part of it, but the major
was preliminary to Ragsdale, and then we've got the Vogel at this point, as I recall. The last one was
the federal one.
Correct. Representative Krupp is right.
Thank you.
Sorry, could you please set up my
question? I know you're not an attorney, so I don't want to ask you a legal question because you don't feel comfortable not answering. But
he's a whole lot more honest than a lot of attorneys, and he's a lot smarter than most of them, too. Yeah.
And he's not asking for a credit for his time served here.
Good behavior.
Anyway, do you feel that there's good legal standing for private retirees and private pension plans to sue the state of Oregon over tax inequity now that we are not collecting the tax from state employees, retired, and federal retirees? Is that a possibility that PERS has considered?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krupp, no, frankly, we haven't gotten into, in our discussions, the ramifications of the private retirees. But I would go back to the Davis versus Michigan Supreme Court of the United States decision, which involved only federal and state and local government retirees. And that decision indicated that they must be treated equally. It didn't say anything about private retirees. I think, and this is my own opinion, I think it's more of a fairness issue that the private retirees are even included in Senate Bill 7. Now, I didn't draft it. I wasn't particularly consulted on it, but I think it was more that than it was a concern for legal action taking place after. I may be completely wrong, but...
Well, Mr. Chair, I am not a drafter of legislation. I am a co-sponsor of this legislation with Senator Yee and Senator Adams. I am concerned that there is a possibility that state or private retirees could sue for under the guise of tax inequity, and the state would then have to cough up several hundred million dollars more to, as we've done with several retirees, and this cycle just continues to go on. And I agree with Senator Sell. I think we either have to either exempt everybody or we have to tax everyone.
Representative Leonard is recognized.
I think it's important to make it clear that to say that federal and state retirees aren't paying taxes in this time isn't exactly accurate. They don't pay taxes for pension time accrued up to 1991. And so they do after that.
After that.
The other, I guess I have a broad question, and that is, whoever can answer, I don't know if Fred is the right person, but I'm just curious about the reasoning behind people not paying taxes on the first $50,000 of retirement income, other than nobody wants to really pay taxes, or people like taxes as long as somebody else pays it. I get those two basic premises, but what's the basic premise behind the first $50,000 being exempt, which, again, is further than what the current law allows, further than what the current law does, that those time accrued since 1991 is taxed just within, say, from the public employees, federal and state, local, from 91 to 99, and from the sign on, they pay no taxes. Have we had is there a theory behind why that makes sense?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leonard will answer that to the extent of my knowledge, and that is that we were asked, I was contacted by Legislative Revenue with the question, where are the majority of PERS retirees' benefit level? Is it less than, do most PERS retirees receive a benefit in benefits less than $50,000 a year? And my answer was yes, they do. And we had looked at our records and determined that by far the majority, percentage wise, received
91 is on that, or even up to now,
up to the present time. And so my response was that the majority do not receive more than $50,000. And I'm sure that the research was going on at that time as to where this cutoff should be, if there was going to be one. Beyond that, I don't know. I just am aware that we were contacted to find out what that number was.
I guess just to follow that up, I guess my concern would be, I mean, we don't have a sales tax. We have a fairly controlled property tax now. And then that's also limited to $15 a thousand, and then the growth of that is limited to, what, now 3%. If a person were in another state, retired with a retirement income of $50,000, why wouldn't they move to Oregon, I guess I'd wonder. And then what cost is there associated with an influx of a older group of citizens who I think most people would think require more and more services. I'm just wondering if this is going to completely fall out.
Well, I would say, Mr. Chairman, whether that was certainly, I'm sure a consideration that it was beyond the scope of what our analysis was. But on the other hand, retirement communities can be economically advantageous to an area. We've seen that in certain parts of Oregon, where Southern Oregon, Central Oregon have had an influx of retirement, and it's a good, clean industry.
And a professional school teacher. Representative Hansen is recognized.
Thank you. Did you run any numbers on what the financial impact would be if we just very cleanly repealed 3249?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, yes, we did. For the repeal of 3349, we did do a fiscal analysis on that. And
that is in our
estimate. It should be included and contained within the LFOs.
We have a
chairman of the committee, the fiscal impact fee, current public employees retirement from the actuary estimates that employers will save 1.02% of covered payroll per year. And if using $5.7 billion, that would be a savings to employers of $116 million in a biennium. There is also additional information provided in the revenue impact, which would show the savings, and that those have been those use inflation numbers. That they work with the actuary first to first actually estimated increase in inflation. The rate is consistent, and it follows the set of covered payroll. So there is savings that was questioned.
Okay. And then what would the revenue impact be?
The revenue impact is the revenue impact statement of about $250 million per.
But that's if you roll in the private.
Yes, the public employee retirement system only is the top number, the $165 million, and then the $203 million in lost revenues. The savings to all public employee retirement system employers in a biennium would be in excess of $116 million.
Okay.
For
that
local employers. That would be all employers.
Every payroll is currently estimated at $5.7 billion a year, and a little over 1% of that per year would be 116.
So, Mr. Chair, if I'm understanding Dallas correctly, if we just repeal 3349, then the state will no longer be paying out the state and local government salaries.
That is correct.
Okay, so everyone who's an employer paying into the PERS system will no longer be paying out about $116 million in the current, in the 9901 biennium, correct?
Correct.
Okay. However, the implication of that is that if we just did that, then state employees would no longer get their 9.89 offset. And then in effect, then we're saying then that state retirees are going, pre-91, are going to be taxed at the 9% level.
Not taxed.
If you just repeal 3349, that was Gary's question. If you just repeal 3349, did nothing else,
then everybody would be taxed.
Then everyone would be taxed.
Right. State people are taxed, they're just going to be taxed on less income.
Right.
But with 3349 repealed, let me just make sure I understand. If 3349 were to be repealed, then there would be no collections. As provided under 3349, there'd be no collections on the public employee retirement systems to accommodate the payments that were made back under the Hughes case, where the state public employees really had to pay out the benefits to pay the taxes on the loss of the contractual obligations that the courts deemed that there were between the state or the public employee retirement system and the state of Oregon, because that was the State Department of Revenue was involved, as I recall, at that point.
Mr. Chair, are you saying that 3349 not only authorized the additional payment of 9.89%, but also authorized a collection of 9%?
It did not change the existing state tax of about 9%. Right.
Yeah.
Right. It did not tamper with the state tax code at all.
No, not with the state tax code, but with the contributions.
With the contributions, it did. Yes, sir.
Right.
And contributions were increased to fund this outgo.
To fund the outgo, and that's. See, that's the problem. If I've got kind of a timeline, and the timeline maybe figured out, but I want to see if we can follow the timeline so that I can get a better feel for what's actually happened. Back in the Davis versus Michigan was a Supreme Court settlement which said that you could not
create a special class of taxpayers. And at that time, Oregon and Michigan were taxing identically, and that is that in Oregon and Michigan, federal retirees were exempt as to a portion, perhaps, of their retirement, but state employees were exempt as to a total amount as to the state tax on the retirement.
So what we had was we had a difference between the federal retirees and the state retirees. The state being their state at this point being totally exempt, and the federal being partially exempt. I've forgotten what the limits were, but there was some okay. $3,000, $5,000, $8,000, $10,000, $12,000 limit.
I don't recall either.
Back during that particular time, and that there should be no special class of taxpayers. The state of Oregon, as a result of that, made a decision back in the 1993 legislature, was it that it would go ahead and tax?
1991.
Was it in the fact in 91?
Right, and the Davis actually was in 89.
Davis settled in 89.
Yes, sir.
And the 10 of 89, what's the magic in that? Was that when it was settled with regard to the Supreme Court?
I just have 1989 was the Davis versus Michigan.
In 91 is when the legislation went into effect.
It's when this legislation went into effect.
From that point on, public employees pay tax.
Okay, so 10 of 91, okay, so this is in 1989 Supreme Court case. And so 10 of 91, then what happened was that the state of Oregon made a decision from that point forward that all state employees as well as federal employees would then pay tax on 100% of all retirement. Okay, so now we have this issue of no special class of taxpayers because everyone is going to pay the same rate of tax. Then we have the Hughes, I believe, as the next lawsuit. And then the Hughes lawsuit, Hughes comes back, and that's against the state of Oregon because it was an implied contract, or it was a contract. And Senator Crow, you had worked for a public employee retirement system, or had contributions, so you may very well know back during then, but it indicated that there was a contractual relationship between the state of Oregon and its employees. And with those employees, that this would be, that the state employees should continue to enjoy this tax-free status under this implied contract.
Or that they have experienced damages and should be compensated for damages.
And the damages were that now everyone was going to be paying their taxes. Now that's, go ahead.
I'm just stretching.
Okay. Stretch some more if you'd love. I need to get this timeline figured out. So what you have then is you have the state coming forward as a result of Hughes and basically making a fairly substantial, and I say the state, it actually, didn't it come out of the PERF fund?
It did.
Okay.
It absolutely did.
Okay, and so what we've got is a PERF fund contribution coming towards and paying the amount was 9.5%, is that what it was?
9.89%.
Back to the employees that were then presently retired to give them this windfall to now accommodate the fact that...
Not a windfall, pay the damage.
That's in the contract price. And that's why I'm having to send you to Senator Trell on this process.
The public sector is a windfall, the private sector is equity.
Equity, right. Okay.
And then the next thing that happened is that we come back and now the federal retirees say, wait a minute, come back and look at the original Davis v. Michigan and see what the original finding of fact was, and that is that you cannot create any special class of taxpayer. And what have you done when you paid these folks tax? You have just violated the first tenet of Davis v. Michigan. And so we have, and I believe it was legislation 91, 93, 95, and 97. In each of those sessions, there was a separate set of legislation that tried to address that. Now, Mr. McDonald, am I?
You're right on, Mr. Chairman. A couple of the dates are a little off, but it doesn't change the plot at all.
Okay.
It was 95 for 3349 when that was passed, and the settlement of which you're speaking now was the Vogel versus Department of Revenue.
This is Vogel.
Vogel Dixon. No, not.
This is Vogel here.
Yeah, you have it on the right. You have over there Vogel versus Department. That was the one that determined that the federal retirees are.
That's right. Vogel then had to make the federal retirees whole.
That's correct.
Okay, that's exactly right. And that was versus against the Department of Revenue. Because they had, in effect, they had paid in their taxes to the Department of Revenue, and they then felt like there had been a new class of taxpayer. And what happened is that everyone from 91 forward was being taxed on all of their retirement, mm-hmm. including the federal retirees. And now what happens is that under the Vogel decision, they said, wait a minute, you've created a new class of taxpayer under the Hughes decision, and so now there has to be a refund. And that's, we've dealt with that in this subcommittee, that refund issue. And so the refund, and that's $107 million, plus or minus at that particular point, that we've already dealt with, plus some interest on that. That was to bring the federal retirees. Now that's in addition to the 1994 through 1997 issue. This is the 1991 through 1993 issues that we dealt with in a substantive fashion in this earlier in this particular session. So that left the federal retirees whole. But now we have the issue of the 9.89 that has been paid out, that is now being collected under House Bill 3349. Now, I need to know where we're headed in this whole process. Are we after, at this particular point, to say, wait a minute, we have overpaid these folks out of the PDRF fund, we've overpaid them, we need to freeze their benefits, and we're going to come back and make everyone, as opposed to being taxable, with which the tax has been paid, make everyone non-taxable? I'll get to go back to one of the authors of the bill. President Krupp, can you help me with those issues? I'm sure.
Well, Mr. Chair, that was our intention. That was to choose the direction that we would simply make all pensions in the state of Oregon pre-1991 non-taxable. So if you were retired pre-1991 and you were with a private pension, then you would be essentially taxed in the same status as federal retirees and state retirees for not paying taxes.
And taxing those people to retire after 1981. Are they taxed?
Yes.
They are.
Yes. We will continue that.
The whole...
Well, that was the original concept. Now, I don't know if... I haven't seen the bill since you've been to my business, so I don't know where it stands today. It still hasn't worked. Okay.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Representative Kraft, you're exactly correct. It would exempt everybody. It would exempt every retiree in this state from state taxation. So the 9% tax would go away. And the exception is, as Senator Leonard and Senator Trove brought up, is that for service after 1991, that benefits earned on service after 1991 would be taxed. So eventually this thing will go away.
Right.
However, in the meantime, and Mr. Chairman, you indicated that we had paid out a lot of money, and we did. We paid retroactive benefits to make everybody whole. But at that time, we paid that out, but at the time they were paying taxes. So whatever we paid out, this bill would not try to recapture. And state tax revenue came in during that time, so that is kind of a wash. That's not a problem with regard to Senate Bill 7. So, but what it does, it just clean sheet of paper, no taxation of any retiree in the state of Oregon for benefits earned on service accrued prior to September or October of 91.
Now, I want to make sure that I understand the term wash. I've been a little concerned about that. When we paid out 9.89%, and goes back to the PERS recipients, and those folks go ahead and pay the taxes on, they're not paying 100% taxes. The highest tax rate would be 9% of the state, so they would pay taxes if they received a $10,000 check. They would pay taxes of as much as $900.
That's correct. However, the tax rate, as you indicate, is 9%. The 0.89 was added to the 9 because that was additional income that these people were receiving that they were going to have to pay tax on. So, and it was calculated out to be that that would be the additional 0.89%.
It wouldn't be a wash.
It's close.
The other way.
And actually, the retirees were not made completely whole because their income increased because of this benefit increase. The 8.9 helped them pay the state tax, but it didn't help them pay the federal tax. Right. So that's why I answered Senator Cho. Partly, some will benefit because of that. Not a lot, but a little.
Representative Leonard is recognized.
I am just curious why anyone would think that it's in Hughes versus the state of Oregon, state public employees successfully sued on the grounds that they had been damaged. Why, if we repealed the statute passed in the 91 session and took away the benefit, 9.89% benefit increase to public employees and tax them, some public employees would argue they again have been harmed.
I'm sorry, I didn't follow that entirely.
Well, it didn't seem like we've learned from the lessons of the last few years. I mean, if the legislature made a decision in 91 to increase state and local government public employees' pensions by 9.89% to offset the tax, what makes us think that if in 1999 we repeal the 1991 statute, public employees who benefit from the 9.89% benefit increase couldn't argue successfully in court that you can't just take away a benefit that I have?
Well, Representative, that's a valid point, and that would be inequitable to do that. The bill says that you not only rescind 3349, but you also rescind any taxation of that at the same time. So it's a wash for the employee.
No, it was there today, but it is, there are many examples when it is not a wash. And a number of public employees have benefited by that trade-off. And I think the state went to great pains in 1991 to try to say these two issues aren't connected. This is a benefit increase over here, and this is a tax over here. And there are people who would argue that they've benefited by that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leonard, the wording in 3349, however, was constructed so that if taxes went away, that was not a contractual right benefit increase. So that if taxes went away, the benefit goes away. Now, however, there is one rub to that hasn't come up yet in the chair's chronological review, and that is there was a Senate Bill 656, and that might ring a bell with some, but that was in the 91 session, I believe, and it was a partial benefit increase to help compensate for the taxes that PERS retirees were paying, and it was 1 to 4% depending upon years of service. And that is part and parcel of this. The intent is to repeal 656 so that taxes go away and the benefits go away, which seems to be a reasonable approach. But some will argue that the 656 part of it is a contract right. But the 3349 part of it is not a contract right. That is correct.
Sure. So if you look just at Senate Bill 7 as it is, A and Go Senate Bill 7 as it is, with all its features, do you see that if we accepted this bill, we would face possible litigation over it? Are there some things that will be litigated if we go this route?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Trow, I suppose that possibility does exist. But on the other hand, I would think that the risk of litigation would be less with the passage of Senate Bill 7 than it would be without it.
So if we stay with the status quo, we're likely to be sued again. Are we already being sued again?
As Representative Krupp points out, there is a distinct possibility that the private retirees would have litigation.
That essentially they're waiting to see what we do with Senate Bill 7 before anything occurs.
Now, the court case, as you pointed out, didn't deal at all with private retirees.
No, they didn't.
And are we somehow in the process of these decisions getting away from any special class that gets special privileges, or is that still in existence so that they would have something to sue on? They could claim in the past somehow or other there were special classes.
And really, this is getting far out of my realm of knowledge. We should really have a tax attorney from the Department of Revenue here to answer that kind of a question.
I'm sorry.
No, that's fine.
It's hard to know what to do.
Yes, it is.
It costs the state so much money.
I remember, Senator Trow, when 3349 was passed, whether or not, what were the odds of the federal retirees bringing suit, and it was self a calculated risk that they would not do that. And if they did, they wouldn't prevail. They would not prevail, and that was the Ragsdale decision. The Ragsdale decision actually held up the 656 benefit increase. And so that was even more reason that everyone thought that it would hold up against the federal retiree suit.
For me to understand the revenue impact, maybe I could go over just the table of balance a little bit. Senate Bill 7, under in 99-201, there'd be a $96 million impact to the state general fund. Okay. The offset would be that we would be saving. Now, are these figures at the bottom then the offset to saving it we decrease profit of benefits?
That is correct.
Okay, so we'd be saving $82 million between the general fund and school?
According to the legislative revenue office, yes.
So that'd mean like a net impact of about $14 million to the general fund?
That would be to a local government in a sense.
But we fund schools.
You're right.
It's not one for one to the general fund. All of the revenue loss is yes to the general fund. The gain from employers' contributions don't all accrue to the state's general fund. They accrue to local governments. Cities and counties, school districts, the yardstick, I can give them roughly one-third, 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 that's said. So roughly one-third of the cost savings to employers would accrue to the state, but all of the revenue loss would be to the state. Now, and I'm not sure the school funding, and this is not my area, I'm not sure the school funding, it carves out the retirement benefits and funds them differently. I'm not an expert in that.
Well, obviously it's coming out of different places, but I'm trying to understand the overall impact. If we add up all of the savings to various governments, it would be $132
million? Yes.
And that's offsetting the $96 million loss? Now, again, it's to different government agencies.
Yes.
Then in the second biennium, there would be the loss of $259 million through general funds, but all government agencies would be saving, I'm just using rough figures for this, $185 million.
If that's what it's about, yes.
So we'd have a net, I guess, taxes lost about $70 million.
Some of it would be a loss overall.
Okay.
But remember, the PERF is not the general fund, and I need to make sure that we understand where we're coming from here, because contributions not made into the PERS do not necessarily increase the general fund.
Yeah.
Sure. I just wonder, Fred, have you looked at these figures?
From
Legislative Fiscal? Yeah.
No.
I can't imagine that the state general fund lost them from the taxes. It would be only $96 million. And then the decrease in the benefits, the employer contribution would go down much more than the state would lose in taxes.
Are we dropping the benefits for 2 years and the taxes for one?
The private
retirees, that doesn't kick in until 2001.
2002. This would only take effect for 3 quarters of the biennium, because it all kicked in on January 1st, 2000.
Well, what I'm suggesting is I can't imagine that the savings, because all the local governments and the employers are going to save, basically, is the cost of paying for this bill, House Bill 3349. That's all they're going to save, right? And I can't imagine that those savings are going to be in this order. Schools, general fund $17 million, schools $65 million, other funds $24 million. Are those the things we're adding in? Local government $25 million? Is that the cost? Does that thing cost that much? I can't believe it.
Well, Senator Troll, if I may, if, for instance, the Albany School District, their additional PERS obligation this year under, just this year, not by any, but this year under 3349 is $600,000. Lebanon is $400,000. My school district, Central Wind, little tiny school district.
Well, is that the additional assessment with everything or just from 1249, or 3349?
That's your...
So we got
that's just 3349. That is not their full PERS complement. I have charts. Filed for $60,000. They go to $80,000 next year. Just for 3349.
Fred must know the cost for 3349.
I do.
What is the cost per year for all employers?
For all employers per year, for the year 1999-2000, the fiscal year is $58,200,000.
See, that's... You're showing a lot more money than 58 million. Are you showing 2 years?
2 years is double that, of course. Uh-huh. And that's the figure that Dallas is using.
That's the figure. That's the figure. That's the figure. That's the figure.
Well, he's talking about the savings.
The per savings. Yeah, 3349 has your deal.
And that dollar amount again, Fred, was?
$58,200,000, and that is for 1 year? Yes.
Well, that's
$116,000 for two.
Okay. And that's the additional cost that you're charging me.
That's the additional cost for $33.49.
Overall, for all employers?
Yes. And as Dallas indicated, it'd be about a third, third, third.
Does that cost increase per year, or does it decrease? Or stay?
It decreases over time, Senator, because of the 1991 kicking in. Fewer retirees are getting less money because it eventually goes away.
Would it decrease about 5%, 10% a year?
Not quite. I don't. It wouldn't be that much if we did a straight line over.
Geological.
Hard one. Let's go ahead and let Alex from Lakeside
Systems. The actuarial number that they get is to level the payments over the 30 years. Is that not correct, Greg?
That's right.
So that 1.02%, the actuarial cost, is takes into account the drop-off in the future.
That's benefit. Right.
It levels and the payment.
That's right.
So
thank
that cost stays.
Thank you. That's right.
So it would be 1.02% of payroll per year for about 30 years.
That's right.
Okay. And there's the phase-in, the optional phase-in that some agents suggest. I think schools have a three-year phase-in optional, and other governments have a mandatory opt-in program of the payment from the 3349.
Oh, I now know what you're speaking. We do have an option of plans with options that employers can select from as to how they phase it in. They can start paying for it now, or they can pay for it a little bit later, kind of a thing. But it's still the same dollars. Right.
Could you give me the totals for the 2001, 2003 biennium, 2003, 2005, in terms of the savings to all government agencies, local schools?
Well, for the 2001-2003, Representative Trump, it would be the same number, the $116,400,000.
I mean, it may be a little bit more if there were salary increases.
That
could go up by 2%.
It could.
Yeah, but how does that jive with your figures here, Dallas?
My figures are on the third page. The revenue impact, I think the legislative revenue office, they may have used different projections for different rates of increases of covered payroll for the various schools and other areas. I don't know exactly what the legislative revenue officer's model is. I just used the public employees retirement system covered payroll of $5.7 billion and 1.02%.
Your figures don't quite agree with Travis.
Mine more or less tied to Fred.
I think he actually got his from me, from our actuary. The $116 million.
Right, but if the 2001-2003 biennium, based on what I'm seeing here, is considerably more than $116
million. Yeah, I think it may be appropriate that where we get a set of figures that the state prepared by legislative revenues, we're going to go ahead and ask Mr. Yates from Legislative Revenue to see if he was prepared to join us and maybe be barraged by some of these questions. These are important here. Representative Hansen.
Well, another question, and again, it's with numbers. If on the revenue impact, could we get what? No, I guess we don't need it. It is here. I'm happy.
Well, we sure shoot a hole in the budget if we just went ahead and pass this last block, couldn't we? Because I don't know if this is anywhere in the
anybody
go to a work session on
anybody's budget? Just in the Republican budget?
I have no idea. Is it in the Democrat budget?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Yates.
Did you do all this to us?
What if you want to know about something? We're we're struggling with some questions relative to Tag Bill 7 as they engrossed relative to the potential of a repealer in effect under Tag Bill 7 of House Bill 3349 and a fiscal impact to the state's general fund.
Yeah. Okay. And the question?
And the question is, how will the state fare when it's all done relative to the comments at the bottom of the revenue impact for the proposed legislation? We've been discussing the issues of the state agency, the general funds of the state, and the schools, which we understand are in part coming from the state, and then the other funds, or other funds, I guess I didn't know what those were, and then local governments would be states, or the counties, cities and counties, and other municipalities other than schools.
Correct.
Okay. Is there a net amount? Do we net any of the state general fund, TERS retirees, and the 99-201 biennium against any of the, let's see, the assessments that are shown below?
You have some freedom there, I think, in terms of what conceptually you're doing. The revenue impact essentially shows you what's happening to the tax revenues, and that's the money that's going into the Department of Revenue, the personal income tax, and flowing into the general fund. And that's down, as you can see, substantially. And that's the revenue impact, and that's the end of the story, as far as I'm concerned. But when you're looking at the general fund and the impact, in some sense, of on the general fund of the whole bill, you have to consider the fiscal impact, which has, you could look at it narrowly as just the agencies that are funded by general fund revenues and what happens to the cost that those agencies incur in terms of PERS assessment. You can look at it a little more broadly by saying, well, the schools, really what they get is the bottom line, the dollars that they get is what comes out of the state school fund. And you can make that less, dollar for dollar, if you like, for the reduction in their costs, because again, on them, the PERS assessments go down. You can do it somewhat broader in saying, okay, the Department of Transportation is going to save some money. We're going to get more asphalt on the roads because they get to pay less to PERS. Okay, that's not general fund, clearly, but it's sort of a state of Oregon impact. Then you go one step further, it's harder to say, okay, somehow state government is affected by a reduction in the cost for local government. That's why I laid those out there. You know, it's not a choice I can make. It's something you've got to decide what you feel comfortable with in terms of the overall impact of the bill. Is it just general fund impact? Is it a state impact? Is it all government, all Oregon government?
How is the PERS made whole in this process they would not be collecting under House Bill 3349 and yet have paid out the 9.89%? How are they made whole?
Mr. Chairman, we will be made whole. We will recover to the PERS trust fund every dollar that we have paid out. So there will be some continuation of payments made into the system by all employers until we are whole. What you see here is a net reduction in the savings that we've provided is a net reduction. We still have paid out the dollars up to this point. We will get those dollars back.
So
through contributions.
Okay, so the amount that we're showing here is not shown broad, it's shown just net?
That's correct.
Okay, all right. So
Which is still substantial. I mean, that still represents to employers a reduction, as has been pointed out, of 1.02% of payroll and $116 million in a biennium. That's the net. That is the net. And we've been very careful to consider that.
Has anybody thought about if we just didn't implement this until the next biennium, whether that would what that would do?
Mr. Chairman, from our Senator Trump, from our standpoint, no, we haven't. The savings, what it would do is the savings would be somewhat less because we will have paid out about $116 million over the next 2 years. So, but that essentially would be the only difference.
I guess if I may, Mr. Chair, I would look at it in terms of when you're able to reduce the agency assessments. If you act now, I'm not just sure when the board will actually move to reduce those assessments, but probably in the near future. If you wait a year, obviously it's going to be a year before the assessments are reduced. So during that period, you would continue to have more money coming into the general fund, but the assessments would stay up.
This would get at the problem of the assessments being so high and causing everybody a problem if we implemented it immediately. The reason for suddenly extending the tax-free status to private employment retirement plans is one, I suppose, an equity argument. The other is we're likely to get sued argument. And probably will get sued. The question is whether they would win that suit or not. We don't show the private retirees any figures for them until 2001, 2003. Is that because the bill itself delays that feature?
That is correct.
That is, okay. And then we begin to see that happening. So the cost of doing this becomes a rather significant, if we do that especially, a significant hit on the general fund, or on our revenues.
And with no offsetting reduction in agency assessments or anything of that kind, it's a pure hit on the general fund for the revenue loss.
Okay, so we do have the offset, that pinpoint, representative of that money.
Assuming the major description of the revenue impact, that this applies to retirees age 55 and older?
The age 55 and older limit is a federal limit, Representative Leonard. I think that's imposed under federal as far as charter from.
I think that's federal except for public safety employees.
I beg your pardon. 59.5 is the standard retirement age. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, if I may, the state is free to choose whatever age it chooses here in this condition, this situation. We do have programs that are tied to that age. We have programs that are tied to 62 and 65. The attempt here, I think, and I don't want to speak for anyone in this, but I think the attempt was you have a lot of early retirees and this sort of thing that are fairly young, and you wanted to afford sort of similar treatment to the private sector that you're getting to the public sector, and that was just to try and keep a balance.
Except that under current law, public safety employees 25 years of service can retire at age 50. So this is a change from the current law.
I'm sorry, I mean, Mr. Chair, this applies only to private retirees. The age 55.
No, that's just, okay. I'm on page 4, line 30.
Okay.
That's under the line 29. So that the current standards for public employees do not change with respect to when they can retire.
Yeah.
Under this bill, in terms of taxes.
Senator Schill?
No. When we think of repealing House Bill 3349 and those benefit increases that were given, the repeal would not be retroactive where you wouldn't go back and say, you owe the state money, pay us back. Would it mean that simply you just reduce everybody's check, reconstitute, refigure what they get and just start paying them a reduced amount? Is that how you would do it? What about their claim that they had been damaged and you're paying damages, and whether or not you will have paid complete damages, even if the tax goes away. What about that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tro, you're correct in that we would reduce the amount of the benefit. We would not attempt to collect any retroactive payments that have been made. Earlier discussion, we feel that if they paid their taxes, they got their benefit increase, what's been done has been done. This Senate Bill 7 would be prospective in that regard. And as far as your second question is concerned, I'm not tracking with it. I don't think
they are damaged in part because they are paying taxes when they were promised they would not have to pay taxes. Now, part of this deal in this bill is to eliminate them paying taxes, right? So they won't be paying, they won't be damaged any further, but will you have paid the full extent of their previous damages?
For some, we will have paid more than the damage. For some, we will have paid less than the damage. What
problems does that pose for you?
Senator, I really don't. I couldn't conjecture.
Better go to your attorney.
The problem is a good settlement of the lawsuit. The problem is a good settlement of the lawsuit. Some got more and some got less than they should have under that, and not without trying to.
Those who got more don't have a beef, but those who got less got a beef. They can go to court, right?
I would say that it would be possible. But what the amount that they got that was less is not
a lot.
A lot.
Yeah.
Okay. And it was agreed to, I might add, it was agreed to by the retirees in the settlement. The clause used. That's right.
Okay. We'll leave it at that.
Colleagues, the colleagues today is a very major issue, and that is this could be a very substantial savings. The local government, whose representative Trump has brought out,
why did we have to pass that other bill today?
Some of that.
The one that set up the third tier.
Oh, did that get passed up today?
Yeah.
You passed that up
today? I voted against it, but we passed it.
Well, that may be moved here is when we're all done here, if we pass on this. This issue, then, is that the relative to the private retirees effective January 1st, 2002, they would be exempt on the first $50,000 if they were retired as of 1991. Is that right? I say that right? Is that correct?
That's correct. That's the intention of the bill.
Okay.
I would restate that it doesn't matter when they retire, but they get the exemption for benefits attributable to work before 1991.
Earned before 1991. Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. I
said.
Okay. Are there any other questions? We do have one other witness signed up from the League of Oregon Cities to offer testimony. Are there any other questions?
Sure, let me be clear.
Sure will.
Our two fine gentlemen are here in front of us. The revenue impact in the first year, the first plan is 99.01. If this bill is introduced, it is $96 million, correct?
Right.
Is that 100% offset It is more than 100% offset, according to the second set of figures directly below it. However, it is not 100% offset out of the state's general fund. Okay, so the actual net loss to the state's general fund only is going to be essentially about $78 million. Is that correct? Subtracting almost $18 million from $96 million?
I would say, Mr. Chair, that's the largest number that you could come up with is a net figure, and that's giving no weight whatsoever to the reduction in the school.
Right. Because Mr. Chair, if I may.
Please follow up with me.
The concept then is that you would reduce $65 million of what my local school district and all the school districts are going to pay out for 3349. You would reduce that by the same amount of support we're giving them currently.
Especially you could choose.
And at that point, then, you get to essentially a break-even figure of
12 million.
Right. We're slightly off.
Okay.
I'm trying to get a clear picture of how this would affect our budget in the 99-01 budget in terms of general fund.
And how about, if I may, other funds? Do we realize some additional savings to the general fund out of the other funds category?
Alan, that's your ballpark.
I don't think it would be significant.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, our total budget is huge. The general fund is not quite half of it, is it? Does it affect the rest of our budget? We have people working in transportation, for instance, who basically must be funded in part out of the gas tax rather than the general fund. That's the other ones you're talking about when you talk about the impact.
That's correct, Senator.
Okay. You think you've got all those costs included?
Well, let me just sort of indicate what I did there in terms of doing the impact from the actuary for PERS. I have the percentage reductions of the percent of payroll. And from the budget, you have payroll by source, other funds, general funds, federal funds.
Okay.
And so those are the basics that I use to multiply by the percentage reduction. And then the growth rates, again, that I've used over time.
The two things that I need to make sure that I understand, and that is, number one, we're saying that schools would save under this program $65,121,000 for the current biennium, and that it's conceivable that could reduce the amount of state general fund support that would have to go to schools if the state chose to do that. If not, then it's a windfall to the schools, and they've got $65 million more for current expenditures.
I would agree with that.
Okay. And the second thing, thank you very much, Mr. Bruce. The second thing that I need to be absolutely certain about is that I'm still having some problems seeing how actuarially the public employee retirement funds are left substantially intact if we do away with 3349. That collection, that local government would be paying that much less. I'm still struggling with how actuarially we're going to keep the public employee retirement trust funds intact, the integrity of them.
All right, Mr. Chairman, included in future contribution rates for all of our employers, state, schools, and all local governments will be enough to recover the funds that we paid out.
In tier one?
Everybody that is retired is a tier one retiree.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
I think this bill does some real good things in the first biennium. There is a hit to the general fund, but it's not, compared to some of the other things we've talked about, it's not really substantial. There's the $65 million savings to the schools. The two other areas that we see $24 million savings in to other funds,
other funds,
which in effect is more asphalt.
mm-hmm. and more other mm-hmm. other things that we can spend that
local government. Local government could be more asphalt too.
The twenty-five million to local government obviously is going to help local services
absolutely
significantly. Where I run into the problems is the next 2 billion when we roll in the private employees. And what I would really like to see would be if one, we could either have an amendment prepared or a financial breakdown prepared in terms of what this bill would look like if we split out the private retirees. And then it gives you a couple other options you could do. One, we could have legislative physical fee, how much of the tax break we could give to private employees.
Is the line of $93 million in the 0103?
Yeah,
is it not the total when you say split it out?
Well, I'm struggling a little bit here from the standpoint that I've added up in 2001 and 2003. It looks to me like we've got about $185 million in savings. But we're paying a benefit or we're losing $259 million in revenue. So it looks to me like we've got about a $70 million loss. We're getting a $93 million tax break.
Well, that's what Republicans call tax fairness. Now, that's what Democrats call a tax break.
So we've got... But I'm wondering.
We're being very fair to corporations, and we're being very fair to the wealthy.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
But I'm wondering if there's a way that tax fairness to retirees could be shaped in a way that it would be revenue neutral in the next 2 biennium. Okay, if you had to cut off at 25,000 or 50,000.
And did you run into those kinds of numbers, Mr. Yates?
No, I did not.
Okay. Before we go into any extensive modifications, I think it would be nice to be able to take a look at some of those things. But at present, the bill is before us, and it has passed from the Senate Committee on Revenue with a unanimous vote, with only Senator Beyer not present. We are out of time. The House takes back up at 5:00. What I would like to do is go ahead and carry this session over until 3:00 tomorrow, if we may. We don't have anything else on our calendar tomorrow, so if it's okay, we'll continue on with the public session, public hearing dealing with Senate Bill 7A and Drills until tomorrow at even time, 3:00. Thank you very much. Thank you, Jack. I'm sorry to put you through this, but I have to have...